Chickens, go figure. November 18th, 1984. I had a dream last night that I think breaks the creative logjam on it. Suppose there's a kind of beam holding the Earth, or even multiple Earths, in place, and that the beam's generator rests on the shell of a turtle. I could make that part of the book's climax. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm sure I read somewhere that in Hindu mythology there's a great turtle that bears us all on his shell, and that he serves Gan, the creative overforce. Also, I remember an anecdote where some lady says to some famous scientist, "This evolution stuff is ridiculous. Everyone knows that a turtle holds up the universe." To which the scientist, wish I could remember his name, but I can't, replies, "That may be, madam, but what holds up the turtle?" Scornful laugh from the lady who says, "Oh, you can't fool me. It's turtles all the way down." Ha! Take that, ye rational men of science. Anyway, I keep a blank book by my bed, and I've gotten so I write down a lot of dreams and dream elements, without even fully waking up. This morning I'd written, "Remember the turtle," and this, "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth. His thought is slow but always kind. He holds us all within his mind." Not great poetry, I grant you, but not bad for a guy who was three-quarters asleep when he wrote it. Tabby has been on my case about drinking too much again. I suppose she's right, but... June 10th, 1986. Lovell, Turtleback Lane. Man, am I glad we bought this house. I was scared of the expense to begin with, but I've never written better than I have here. And this is scary, but it's true. I think I want to go back to work on the Dark Tower story. In my heart, I thought I never would, but last night when I was going to the Center General for beer, I could almost hear Roland saying, "There are many worlds and many tales, but not much time." I ended up turning around and coming back to the house. Can't remember the last time I spent a totally sober night, but this is one of that dying breed. It actually feels fucked up not to be fucked up. That's pretty sad, I guess. June 13th, 1986. I woke up in the middle of the night, hungover and needing to pee. While I was standing at the bowl, it was almost as if I could see Roland of Gilead, telling me to start with the lobstrosities. I will. I know just what they are. June 15th, 1986. Started a new book today. Can't believe I'm actually writing about old Long, Tall, and Ugly again. But it felt right from the first page. Hell, from the first word. I've decided it'll be almost like the classic fairy tales in structure. Roland walks along the beach of the Western Sea, getting sicker and sicker as he goes, and there's a series of doors to our world. He'll draw a new character from behind each one. The first one will be a stone junkie named Eddie Dean. July 16th, 1986. I can't believe this. I mean, I've got the manuscript on the desk right in front of me, so I sort of have to, but I still can't. I have written 300 pages in the last month, and the copy is so clean it's positively squeaky. I've never felt like one of those writers who can actually take credit for their work, who say they plot every move and incident. But I've also never had a book that seemed to flow through me like this one has. It's pretty much taken over my life from day one. And you know, it seems to me that a lot of the other things I've written, especially it, are like practice shots for this story. Certainly I've never picked something up after it lay fallow for 15 years. I mean, sure, I did a little work on the stories Ed Furman published in FNSF, and I did a little more when Don Grant published The Gunslinger, but nothing like what I'm up to now. I even dream about this story. I have days when I wish I could quit drinking, but I'll tell you something, I'm almost scared to stop. I know inspiration doesn't flow from the neck of a bottle, but there's something... I'm scared, okay? I feel like there's something... something... that doesn't want me to finish this book. that didn't even want me to start it. Now, I know that's crazy, like something out of a Stephen King story, har-har. But at the same time, it seems very real. Probably a good thing no one will ever read this diary. Very likely they'd put me away if they did. Anyone want to buy a used fruitcake? I'm going to call it The Drawing of the Three, I think. September 19th, 1986. It's done. The Drawing of the Three is done. I got drunk to celebrate. Stoned, too. And what's next? Well, it will be published in a month or so. And in 2 days, I'll be 39. Man, I can hardly believe it. Seems just about a week ago that we were living in Bridgeton and the kids were babies. Ah, fuck, time to quit. The writer's getting maudlin. June 19th, 1987. Got my first author's copy of Drawing from Donald Grant today. It's a beautiful package. I've also decided to let NAL go ahead and do both Dark Tower books and paperback. Give the people what they want. Why the hell not? Of course, I got drunk to celebrate. Only these days, who needs an excuse? It's a good book, but in many ways, it seems like I didn't write the damn thing at all. That it just flowed out of me like the umbilical cord from a baby's navel. What I'm trying to say is that the wind blows, the cradle rocks, and sometimes it seems to me that none of this stuff is mine. That I'm nothing but Roland of Gilead's fucking secretary. I know that's stupid, but a part of me sort of believes it. Only maybe Roland's got his own boss. Ka? I do tend to get depressed when I look at my life. The booze, the drugs, the cigarettes. As if I'm actually trying to kill myself. Or something else is. October 19th, 1987. I'm in Lovell tonight, the house on Turtleback Lane. Came down here to think about the way I'm living my life. Something's gotta change, man, because otherwise, I might as well just cut to the chase and blow my brains out. Something's gotta change. The following item, from the North Conway, New Hampshire Mountain Ear, was pasted into the writer's journal, marked April 12, 1988. Local Sociologist Dismisses Walk-In Tales by Logan Merrill. For at least 10 years, the White Mountains have resounded with tales of walk-ins. Creatures who may be aliens from space, time travelers, or even beings from another dimension. In a lively lecture last night at the North Conway Public Library, local sociologist Henry K. Verdon, author of Peer Groups and Mythmaking, used the walk-in phenomenon as an illustration of just how myths are created and how they grow. He said that the walk-ins were probably originally created by teenagers in the border towns between Maine and New Hampshire. He also speculated that sightings of illegal aliens who cross over the northern border from Canada and then into the New England states may have played a part in kindling this myth, which has become so prevalent. "I think we all know," Professor Verdon said, "that there is no Santa Claus, no tooth fairy, and no actual beings called walk-ins. Yet these tales..." Continued on page 8. The rest of the article is missing. Nor is there any explanation as to why King may have included it in his journal. June 19th, 1989. I just got back from my 1 year Alcoholics Anonymous anniversary. An entire year without drugs or booze. I can hardly believe it. No regrets. Sobering up undoubtedly saved my life and probably my marriage, but I wish it wasn't so hard to write stories in the aftermath. People in the program say, "Don't push it, it'll come." But there's another voice, I think of it as the voice of the turtle, telling me to hurry up and get going. Time is short, and I have to sharpen my tools. For what? For the Dark Tower, of course, and not just because letters keep coming in from people who read The Drawing of the Three and want to know what happens next. Something in me wants to go back to work on the story. But I'll be damned if I know how to get back. July 12, 1989. There are some amazing treasures on the bookshelves down here in Lovell. Know what I found this morning while I was looking for something to read? Shardik, by Richard Adams. Not the story about the rabbits, but the one about the giant mythological bear. I think I'll read it over again. I'm still not writing much of interest. September 21st, 1989. Okay, this is relatively weird, so prepare yourself. Around 10 a.m., while I was writing, while I was staring at the word processor and dreaming about how great it would be to have an ice-cold keg of Bud at least, the doorbell rang. It was a guy from Bangor House of Flowers with a dozen roses. Not for Tab either, but for me. The card read, "Happy Birthday from the Mansfields. Dave, Sandy, and Megan." I had totally forgotten, but today I'm the big 4-2. Anyway, I took one of the roses out, and I kind of got lost in it. I know how strange that sounds, believe me, but I did. I seemed to hear this sweet humming. And I just went down and down, following the curves of the rose, kind of splashing through these drops of dew that seemed as big as ponds. And all the time, that humming sound got louder and sweeter, and the rose got, well, rosier. And I found myself thinking of Jake from the first Dark Tower story, and Eddie Dean, and a bookstore. I even remember the name, the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind. Then, boom, I feel a hand on my shoulder, I turn around, and it's Tabby. She wanted to know who sent me the roses. She also wanted to know if I'd fallen asleep. I said no, but I kind of did, right there in the kitchen. You know what it was like? That scene at the way station in The Gunslinger, where Roland hypnotizes Jake with a bullet. I'm immune to hypnosis myself. A guy got me up on stage at the Topsom Fair when I was a kid and tried it on me, but it didn't work. As I remember, my brother Dave was quite disappointed. He wanted me to cluck like a chicken. Anyway, I think I want to go back to work on the Dark Tower. I don't know if I'm ready for anything that complex after some of the failures of the last couple of years, let's say I'm dubious. But I want to give it a shot just the same. I hear those make-believe people calling to me. And who knows? There might even be a place in this one for a giant bear like Shardik in the Richard Adams novel. October 7th, 1989. I started the next Dark Tower book today, and, as with The Drawing of the Three, I finished my first session wondering why in God's name I waited so long. Being with Roland, Eddie, and Susanna is like a drink of cool water. Or meeting old friends after a long absence. And once again, there is a sense that I'm not telling the story, but only providing a conduit for it. And you know what? That's okie fine with me. I sat at the word processor for 4 hours this morning and did not once think of a drink or any sort of mind-altering drug. I think I'll call this one The Wastelands. October 9th, 1989. No, waste lands, two words. As in the T.S. Eliot poem, his is actually the wasteland, I think. January 19th, 1990. Finished the wastelands tonight, after a marathon 5 hour session. People are going to hate the way it ends, with no conclusion to the riddle contest, and I thought the story would go on longer myself. But I can't help it. I heard a voice speak up clearly in my head, as always it sounds like Roland's, saying, "You're done for now. Close thy book, wordslinger." Cliffhanger ending aside, the story seems fine to me. But as always, not much like the other ones I write. The manuscript is a brick, over 800 pages long. And I created said brick in just a little over 3 months. Unfucking real. Once again, hardly any strikeovers or retakes. There are a few continuity glitches, but considering the length of the book, I can hardly believe how few. Nor can I believe how, when I needed some sort of inspiration, the right book seemed to fly into my hand time after time. Like The Quincunx, by Charles Palliser, with all the wonderful, growly 17th century slang, "Aye, so you do," and "So you will," and "My cully." That Argo sounded perfect coming out of Gasher's mouth, to me at least. And how cool it was to have Jake come back into the story the way he did. Only thing that worries me is what's going to happen to Susanna Dean, who used to be Detta Odetta. She's pregnant, and I'm afraid of who or what the father might be. Some demon? I don't think so, exactly. Maybe I won't have to deal with that until a couple of books further down the line. In any case, my experience is that in a long book, whenever a woman gets pregnant and nobody knows who the father is, that story is headed down the tubes. Don't know why, but as a plot thickener, pregnancy just naturally seems to suck. Oh, well, maybe it doesn't matter. For the time being, I'm tired of Roland and his cotet. I think it may be a while before I get back to them again, although the fans are going to howl their heads off about that cliffhanger ending on the train out of Ludd. Mark my words. I'm glad I wrote it, though. And to me, the ending seems just right. In many ways, Wastelands feels like the high point of my make-believe life. Even better than The Stand, maybe. November 27th, 1991. Remember me saying that I'd get bitched at about the ending of Wastelands? Look at this. Letter follows from John T. Spear of Lawrence, Kansas. November 16th, 91. Dear Mr. King, or should I just cut to the chase and say, Dear Asshole, I can't believe I paid such big bucks for a Donald Grant edition of your Gunslinger book, The Wastelands, and this is what I got. It had the right title anyway, for it was a true waste. I mean, the story was all right, don't get me wrong, great in fact. But how could you tack on an ending like that? It wasn't an ending at all, but just a case of you getting tired and saying, oh well, what the fuck, I don't need to strain my brain to write an ending. Those slobs who buy my books will swallow anything. I was going to send it back, but will keep it because I at least liked the pictures, especially Oi. But the story was a cheat. Can you spell cheat, Mr. King? M-O-O-N. That spells cheat. Sincerely yours in criticism, John T. Spear, Lawrence, Kansas. March 23rd, 1992. In a way, this one makes me feel even worse. Letter follows from Mrs. Coretta Vili of Stowe, Vermont. March 6, 1992. Dear Stephen King, I don't know if this letter will actually reach you, but one can always hope. I have read most of your books and have loved them all. I am a 76 years young grandma from your sister state of Vermont, and I especially like your Dark Tower stories. Well, to the point, last month I went to see a team of oncologists at Mass General, and they tell me that the brain tumor I have looks to be malignant after all. At first they said, don't worry, Coretta, it's benign. Now I know you have to do what you have to do, Mr. King, and follow your muse, but what they're saying is that I will be fortunate to see the 4th of July this year. I guess I've read my last Dark Tower yarn, so what I'm wondering is, can you tell me how the Dark Tower story comes out? At least if Roland and his quartet actually get to the Dark Tower. And if so, what they find there. I promise not to tell a soul, and you will be making a dying woman very happy. Sincerely, Coretta Vili, Stowe, Vermont. I feel like such a shit when I think of how blithe I was concerning the ending of Wastelands. I gotta answer Coretta Vili's letter, but I don't know how to. Could I make her believe I don't know any more than she does about how Roland's story finishes? I doubt it, and yet that is the truth, as Jake says in his final essay. I have no more idea what's inside that damn tower than, well, than Oi does. I didn't even know it was in a field of roses until it came off my fingertips and showed up on the screen of my new Macintosh computer. Would Coretta buy that? What would she say if I told her, Corey, listen, the wind blows and the story comes. Then it stops blowing and all I can do is wait, same as you. They think I'm in charge. Every one of them, from the smartest of the critics to the most mentally challenged reader. And that's a real hoot. Because I'm not. September 22nd, 1992. The Grant edition of The Wastelands is sold out, and the paperback edition is doing very well. I should be happy, and guess I am, but I'm still getting a ton of letters about the cliffhanger ending. They fall into three major categories. People who are pissed off, people who want to know when the next book in the series is coming out, and pissed off people who want to know when the next book in the series is coming out. But I'm stuck. The wind from that quarter just isn't blowing, not just now anyway. Meanwhile, I have an idea for a novel about a lady who buys a picture in a pawn shop and then kind of falls into it. Hey, maybe it'll be Midworld she falls into, and she'll meet Roland. July 9th, 1994. Tabby and I don't fight much since I quit drinking, but oh boy, this morning we had a dilly. We're at the Lovell house, of course, and as I was getting ready to leave on my morning walk, she showed me a story from today's Lewiston Sun. It seems that a Stoneham man, Charles Chip McCausland, was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver while walking on Route 7, which is the road I walk on, of course. Tabby tried to persuade me to stay on Turtleback Lane. I tried to persuade her that I had as much right to use Route 7 as anyone else. And honest to God, I only do half a mile on the blacktop. And things went downhill from there. Finally, she asked me to at least stop walking on Slab City Hill, where the sight lines are so short and there's nowhere to jump if someone happens to get off the road and onto the shoulder. I told her I'd think about it. It would have been noon before I got out of the house if we kept on talking. But in truth, I'll be damned if I'll live my life in fear that way. Besides, it seems to me that this poor guy from Stoneham has made the odds of me getting hit while out walking about 1,000,000 to 1. I told this to Tabby, and she said, the odds of you ever being as successful at writing as you have been are even higher. You've said so yourself. To that, I'm afraid I had no comeback. June 19th, 1995. Bangor. Tabby and I just got back from the Bangor Auditorium, where our youngest and about 400 of his classmates finally got a diploma. He's now officially a high school graduate. Bangor High and the Bangor Rams are behind him. He'll be starting college in the fall, and then Tab and I will have to start dealing with the ever-popular empty nest syndrome. Everybody says it all goes by in the wink of an eye, and you say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it does. Fuck. I'm sad. Feel lost. What's it all for, anyway? What's it all about, Alfie? Ha ha. What, just a big scramble from the cradle to the grave? The clearing at the end of the path? Jesus, that's grim. Meantime, we're headed down to Lovell and the house on Turtleback Lane this afternoon. Owen will join us in a day or two, he says. Tabby knows I want to write by the lake, and boy, she's so intuitive, it's scary. When we were coming back from the graduation exercises, she asked me if the wind was blowing again. In fact, it is, and this time it's blowing a gale. I can't wait to start the next volume of the DT series. Time to find out what happens in the riddling contest that Eddie blows Blaine's computerized mind with silly questions, i.e. riddles, is something I've known for several months now. But I don't think that's the major story I have to tell this time. I want to write about Susan, Roland's first love, and I want to set their cowboy romance in a fictional part of Midworld called Majus, i.e. Mexico. Time to saddle up and take another ride with the Wild Bunch. Meantime, the other kids are doing well, although Naomi had some kind of allergic reaction. Maybe to shellfish. July 19th, 1995. Turtleback Lane, Lovell. As on my previous expeditions to Midworld, I feel like somebody who's just spent a month on a jet-propelled rocket sled, while stoned on hallucinatory happy gas. I thought this book would be tougher to get into, much, but in fact it was once more as easy as slipping into a pair of comfortable old shoes, or those Western-style short boots I got from Bally's in New York 3 or 4 years ago and cannot bear to give up. I've already got over 200 pages. And was delighted to find Roland and his friends investigating the remains of the superflu. seeing evidence of both Randall Flagg and Mother Abigail. I think Flagg may turn out to be Walter, Roland's old nemesis. His real name is Walter O'Dimm, and he was just a country boy to start with. It makes perfect sense in a way. I can see now how, to a greater or lesser degree, every story I've ever written is about this story. And you know, I don't have a problem with that. Writing this story is the one that always feels like coming home. Why does it always feel dangerous as well? Why should I be so convinced that if I'm ever found slumped over my desk, dead of a heart attack, or wiped out on my Harley, probably on Route 7, it'll be while working on one of these weird westerns? I guess because I know so many people are depending on me to finish the cycle. And I want to finish it. God, yes. No Canterbury Tales or Mystery of Edwin Drood in my portfolio, if I can help it, thank you very much. And yet I always feel as if some anti-creative force is looking around for me, and that I'm easier to see when I'm working on these stories. Well, enough with the heebie-jeebies. I'm off on my walk. September 2nd, 1995. I'm expecting the book to be done in another 5 weeks. This one has been more challenging, but still, the story comes to me in wonderful, rich details. Watched Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai last night and wonder if that might not be the right direction for Volume 6, The Werewolves of Endworld or some such. I probably ought to see if any of the little side-of-the-road video rental places around here have got The Magnificent Seven, which is the Americanized version of the Kurosawa film. Speaking of side of the road, I almost had to dive into the ditch this afternoon to avoid a guy in a van swerving from side to side, pretty obviously drunk, on the last part of Route 7, before I turned back into the relatively sheltered environs of Turtleback Lane. I don't think I'll mention this to Tabby. She'd go nuclear. Anyway, I've had my one pedestrian scare, and I'm just glad it didn't happen on the slab City Hill portion of the road. October 19th, 1995. Took me a little longer than I thought, but I finished Wizard and Glass tonight. August 19th, 1997. Tabby and I just said goodbye to Joe and his good wife. They're on their way back to New York. I was glad I could give them a copy of Wizard and Glass. The first bunch of finished books came today. What looks and smells better than a new book? Especially one with your name on the title page. This is the world's best job I've got. Real people pay me real money to hang out in my imagination. Where, I should add, the only ones who feel completely real to me are Roland and his quartet. I think the constant readers are really going to like this one, and not just because it finishes the story of Blaine the Mono. I wonder if the Vermont grandma with the brain tumor is still alive. I suppose not. But if she was, I'd be happy to send her a copy. July 6, 1998. Tabby, Owen, Joe, and I went to Oxford tonight to see the film Armageddon. I liked it more than I expected, in part because I had my family with me. The movie is special effects-driven end-of-the-world stuff. Got me thinking about the Dark Tower and the Crimson King. Probably not surprising. I wrote for a while this morning on my Vietnam story, switching over from longhand to my power book, so I guess I'm serious about it. I like the way Sully John reappeared. Question: will Roland Deschaine and his friends ever meet Bobby Garfield's pal Ted Brodigan? And just who are those low men chasing the old Tedster anyway? More and more, my work feels like a slanted trough where everything eventually drains into mid-world and end-world. The Dark Tower is my Uber story. No question about that. When it's done, I plan to ease back. Maybe retire completely. August 7th, 1998. Took my usual walk this afternoon, and tonight I took Fred Hauser with me to the AA meeting in Freiburg. On the way home, he asked me to sponsor him, and I said yes. I think he's finally getting serious about sobering up. Good for him. Anyhow, he got talking about the so-called walk-ins. He says there are more of them around the seven towns than ever, and all sorts of folks are gossiping about them. How come I never hear anything then? I asked him. To which I got no answer but an extremely funny look. I kept prodding, and finally Fred says, "People don't like to talk about them around you, Steve, because there have been 24 reported on Turtleback Lane in the last 8 months, and you claim not to have seen a single one." To me, this seemed like a non sequitur, and I made no reply. It wasn't until after the meeting, and after I dropped my new pigeon off, that I realized what he was saying. People don't talk about the walk-ins around me because they think that in some crazy way I'm responsible. I thought I was pretty well used to being America's boogeyman, but this is actually sort of outrageous. January 2nd, 1999, Boston. Owen and I are at the Hyatt Harborside tonight and head off to Florida tomorrow. Tabby and I are talking about buying a place there, but haven't told the kids. I mean, they're only 27, 25, and 21. Maybe when they're old enough to understand such things, ha ha. Earlier we met Joe and saw a film called Hurly Burly from the play by David Rabe. Very odd. Speaking of odd, I had some sort of New Year's night nightmare before leaving Maine. Can't remember exactly what it was, but when I woke up this morning, I'd written two things in my dream book. One was Baby Mordred, like something out of a Charles Adams cartoon. That I sort of understand. It must refer to Susanna's baby in the Dark Tower stories. It's the other thing that puzzles me. It says 6-19-99, O Discordia. Discordia also sounds like something out of the DT stories, but it's not anything I have invented. As for 6-19-99, that's a date, right? Meaning what? June 19th of this year. Tabby and I should be back at the Turtleback Lane house by then. But so far as I can remember, it's not anybody's birthday. Maybe it's the date I'm going to meet my first walk-in. June 12th, 1999. It's wonderful to be back at the lake. I've decided to take 10 days off, then finally return to work on the How to Write book. I'm curious about hearts in Atlantis. Will folks want to know if Bobby Garfield's friend Ted Brodigan plays a part in the Tower Saga? The truth is, I really don't know the answer to that. In any case, readership of the Tower stories has fallen off a lot lately. The figures are really disappointing, compared to that of my other books. Except for Rose Matter, which was a real tank job, at least in the sales sense. But it doesn't matter, at least to me. And if the series ever gets done, sales may go up. Tabby and I had another argument about my walking route. She asked me again to quit going out on the main road. Also, she asked me, "Is the wind blowing yet?" Meaning, am I thinking about the next Dark Tower story? I said, "No, Kamala, come, come, the tale has not begun." But it will, and there's a dance called the Kamala in it. That's the one thing I see clearly. Roland dancing. Why or for whom, I don't know. Anyway, I asked T why she wanted to know about the Dark Tower, and she said, "You're safer when you're with the gunslingers." Joking, I suppose. But an odd joke for T. Not much like her. June 17th, 1999. Talked with Rand Halston and Mark Carliner tonight. They both sound excited about moving on from Storm of the Century to Rose Red or Kingdom Hospital, but either one would fill my plate up again. I dreamed of my walk last night and woke up crying. "The tower will fall," I thought. Oh, Discordia, the world grows dark. Question mark. Headline. From the Portland Press Herald, June 18, 1999. Walk-in phenomenon in western Maine continues to resist explanation. June 19, 1999. This is like one of those times when all the planets line up, except in this case it's my family all lined up here on Turtleback Lane. Joe and his family arrived around noon. Their little boy is really cute, say true. Sometimes I look in the mirror and say, "You are a grandfather." And the Steve in the mirror just laughs, because the idea is so ridiculous. The Steve in the mirror knows I'm still a college sophomore, going to classes and protesting the war in Vietnam by day, drinking beer down at Pat's Pizza with Flip Thompson and George McLeod by night. As for my grandson, the beautiful Ethan, he just tugs on the balloon tied to his toe and laughs. Daughter Naomi and son Owen got here late last night. We had a great Father's Day dinner, people saying things to me that were so nice I had to check to make sure I wasn't dead. God, I'm lucky to have family. Lucky to have more stories to tell, lucky to still be alive. The worst thing to happen this week, I hope, will be my wife's bed collapsing under the weight of our son and daughter-in-law. The idiots were wrestling on it. You know what? I've been thinking of going back to Roland's story after all. As soon as I finish the book on writing would actually not be a bad title. It's simple and to the point. But right now the sun is shining, the day is beautiful, and what I'm going to do is take a walk. More later, maybe. From the Portland Sunday Telegram, June 20th, 1999. Stephen King dies near Lovell Home. Popular Maine writer killed while taking afternoon walk. Insider claims man driving lethal van took eyes off the road as he approached King on Route 7. By Ray Ruthier. Lovell, Maine. Exclusive. Maine's most popular author was struck and killed by a van while walking near his summer home yesterday afternoon. The van was driven by Brian Smith of Freiburg. According to sources close to the case, Smith has admitted that he took his eyes off the road when one of his Rottweilers got out of the back of the van and began nosing into a cooler behind the driver's seat. "I never even saw him," Smith is reported to have said shortly after the collision, which took place on what locals call Slab City Hill. King, author of such popular novels as It, Salem's Lot, The Shining, and The Stand, was taken to Northern Cumberland Memorial Hospital in Bridgeton, where he was pronounced dead at 6:02 p.m. Saturday evening. He was 52 years old. A hospital source said the cause of death was extensive head injuries. King's family, which had gathered in part to celebrate Father's Day, is in seclusion tonight. Kamala, come, come. The battle's now begun. And all the foes of men and rose rise with the setting sun.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of The Dark Tower, Book 7 in the Dark Tower series, free.
The Dark Tower 6, Song of Susanna, was written by Stephen King and read by George Guidel. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub, with editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ellen Hurst. The Dark Tower 6, Song of Susanna, was produced and directed by Kelly Gilday. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
And now, a free preview of The Dark Tower, Book 7 in the Dark Tower series.
1999. Reproduction. Revelation. Redemption. Resumption. Part 1. The Little Red King. Dan Titi. Chapter 1. Callahan and the Vampires. 1. Père Don Callahan had once been the Catholic priest of a town, Salem's Lot had been its name, that no longer existed on any map. He didn't much care. Concepts such as reality had ceased to matter to him. This one-time priest now held a heathen object in his hand, a scrimshaw turtle made of ivory. There was a nick in its beak, and a scratch in the shape of a question mark on its back, but otherwise, it was a beautiful thing. Beautiful and powerful. He could feel the power in his hand, like volts. "How lovely it is," he whispered to the boy who stood with him. "Is it the turtle Maturin? It is, isn't it?" The boy was Jake Chambers, and he'd come a long loop in order to return almost to his starting place here in Manhattan. "I don't know," he said. "She calls it the Sholpada. And it may help us, but it can't kill the harriers that are waiting for us in there." He nodded toward the Dixie Pig, wondering if he meant Susanna or Mia when he used that all-purpose feminine pronoun she. Once he would have said it didn't matter because the two women were so tightly wound together. Now, however, he thought it did matter, or would, soon. "Will you?" Jake asked the pair, meaning, "Will you stand? Will you fight? Will you kill?" "Oh, yes," Callahan said calmly. He put the ivory turtle with its wise eyes and scratched back into his breast pocket with the extra shells for the gun he carried, then patted the cunningly made thing once to make sure it rode safely. "I'll shoot until the bullets are gone. And if I run out of bullets before they kill me, I'll club them with the gun butt." The pause was so slight, Jake didn't even notice it. But in that pause, the white spoke to Father Callahan. It was a force he knew of old, even in boyhood. Although there had been a few years of bad faith along the way, years when his understanding of that elemental force had first grown dim and then become lost completely. But those days were gone. The white was his again, and he told God thank you. Jake was nodding, saying something Callahan barely heard. And what Jake said didn't matter. What that other voice said, the voice of something Gan, perhaps too great to be called God, did. "The boy must go on," the voice told him. "Whatever happens here, however it falls, the boy must go on. Your part in the story is almost done. His is not." They walked past a sign on a chrome post, closed for private function. Jake's special friend Oi trotting between them, his head up and his muzzle wreathed in its usual toothy grin. At the top of the steps, Jake reached into the woven sack Susanna Mio had brought out of Calibrin Sturgis and grabbed two of the plates, the risers. He tapped them together, nodded at the dull ringing sound, and then said, "Let's see yours." Callahan lifted the Ruger Jake had brought out of Cala, New York, and now back into it. "Life is a wheel, and we all say thank you." For a moment the pair held the Ruger's barrel beside his right cheek like a duelist. Then he touched his breast pocket, bulging with shells and with the turtle. The Sholpada. Jake nodded.
"Once we're in, we stay together. Always together, with Oi between. On three. And once we start, we never stop."
"Never stop."
"Right. Are you ready?"
"Yes. God's love on you, boy."
"And on you, pair. One, two, three."
Jake opened the door, and together they went into the dim light and the sweet, tangy smell of roasting meat. 2. Jake went to what he was sure would be his death, remembering two things Roland Deschaine, his true father, had said. Battles that last 5 minutes spawn legends that live 1,000 years. And you needn't die happy when your day comes, but you must die satisfied, for you have lived your life from beginning to end, and Ka is always served. Jake Chambers surveyed the Dixie Pig with a satisfied mind. 3. Also, with crystal clarity. His senses were so heightened that he could smell not just roasting flesh, but the rosemary with which it had been rubbed. Could hear not only the calm rhythm of his breath, but the tidal murmur of his blood climbing brainward on one side of his neck and descending heartward on the other. He also remembered Roland saying that even the shortest battle, from first shot to final falling body, seemed long to those taking part. Time grew elastic, stretched to the point of vanishment. Jake had nodded, as if he understood, although he hadn't. Now he did. His first thought was that there were too many of them. Far, far too many. He put their number at close to 100, the majority certainly of the sort Per Callahan had referred to as low men. Some were low women, but Jake had no doubt the principle was the same. Scattered among them, all less fleshy than the low falcon, and some as slender as fencing weapons, their complexions ashy and their bodies surrounded in dim blue auras, were what had to be vampires. Oi stood at Jake's heel, his small, foxy face, stern, whining low in his throat. That smell of cooking meat wafting through the air was not pork. 4. 10 feet between us any time we have 10 feet to give, Pear. So Jake had said out on the sidewalk, and even as they approached the maitre d's platform, Callahan was drifting to Jake's right, putting the required distance between them. Jake had also told him to scream as loud as he could for as long as he could, and Callahan was opening his mouth to begin doing just that, when the voice of the white spoke up inside again. Only one word, but it was enough. "Sholpada," it said. Callahan was still holding the Ruger up by his right cheek. Now he dipped into his breast pocket with his left hand. His awareness of the scene before him wasn't as hyper-alert as his young companion's, but he saw a great deal. The orangey, crimson electric flambeaus on the walls, the candles on each table immured in glass containers of a brighter Halloweenish orange, the gleaming napkins. To the left of the dining room was a tapestry showing knights and their ladies sitting at a long banquet table. There was a sense in here. Callahan wasn't sure exactly what provoked it, the various tells and stimuli were too subtle, of people just resettling themselves after some bit of excitement. A small kitchen fire, say, or an automobile accident on the street. Or a lady having a baby, Callahan thought as he closed his hand on the turtle. That's always good for a little pause between the appetizer and the entree. "Now come, Gileads, come, eyes!" shouted an excited, nervous voice. Not a human one. Of that Callahan was almost positive. It was too buzzy to be human. Callahan saw what appeared to be some sort of monstrous bird-human hybrid standing at the far end of the room. It wore straight-leg jeans and a plain white shirt, but the head rising from that shirt was painted with sleek feathers of dark yellow. Its eyes looked like drops of liquid tar. "Get them!" this horridly ridiculous thing shouted, and brushed aside a napkin. Beneath it was some sort of weapon. Callahan supposed it was a gun, but it looked like the sort you saw on Star Trek. What do they call them? Phasers? Stunners? It didn't matter. Callahan had a far better weapon, and wanted to make sure they all saw it. He swept the place settings and the glass container with the candle in it from the nearest table, then snatched away the tablecloth like a magician doing a trick. The last thing he wanted to do was to trip over a swatch of linen at the crucial moment. Then, with a nimbleness he wouldn't have believed even a week ago, he stepped onto one of the chairs and from the chair to the tabletop. Once on the table, he lifted the sholpada with his fingers supporting the turtle's flat undershell, giving them all a good look at it. "I could croon something," he thought. "Maybe Moonlight Becomes You, or I Left My Heart in San Francisco." At that point, they had been inside the Dixie Pig for exactly 34 seconds. 5. High school teachers, faced with a large group of students in study hall or a school assembly, would tell you that teenagers, even when freshly showered and groomed, reek of the hormones which their bodies are so busy manufacturing. Any group of people under stress emits a similar stink.
and Jake, with his senses tuned to the most exquisite pitch, smelled it here. When they passed the Maitre D's stand, Blackmail Central, his dad liked to call such stations, the smell of the Dixie Pig's diners had been faint, the smell of people coming back to normal after some sort of dust-up. But when the bird creature in the far corner shouted, Jake had smelled the patrons more strongly. It was a metallic aroma, enough like blood to incite his temper and his emotions. Yes, he saw Tweety Bird knock aside the napkin on his table. Yes, he saw the weapon beneath. Yes, he understood that Callahan, standing on the table, was an easy shot. That was of far less concern to Jake than the mobilizing weapon that was Tweety Bird's mouth. Jake was drawing back his right arm, meaning to fling the first of his 19 plates and amputate the head in which that mouth resided when Callahan raised the turtle. It won't work, not in here, Jake thought, but even before the idea had been completely articulated in his mind, he understood it was working. He knew by the smell of them. The aggressiveness went out of it, and the few who had begun to rise from their tables, the red holes in the foreheads of the low people gaping, the blue auras of the vampires seeming to pull in and intensify, sat back down again, and hard, as if they had suddenly lost command of their muscles.
Get them! Those are the ones, sir!
Then Tweety stopped talking. His left hand, if you could call such an ugly talon a hand, touched the butt of his high-tech gun and then fell away. The brilliance seemed to leave his eyes.
They're the ones, sir! Sir!
Another pause. Then the bird thing said,
Oh, sigh, what is that lovely thing that you hold? You know what it is, Callahan said.
Jake was moving, and Callahan, mindful of what the boy gunslinger had told him outside, make sure that every time I look on my right I see your face, stepped back down from the table to move with him, still holding the turtle high. He could almost taste the room's silence, but there was another room. Rough laughter and hoarse, carousing yells, a party from the sound of it, and close by. On the left, from behind the tapestry showing the knights and their ladies at dinner. Something going on back there, Callahan thought, and probably not Elk's poker night. He heard Oi breathing fast and low through his perpetual grin, a perfect little engine. And something else, a harsh, rattling sound with a low and rapid clicking beneath. The combination set Callahan's teeth on edge and made his skin feel cold. Something was hiding under the tables. Oi saw the advancing insects first, and froze like a dog on point, one paw raised and his snout thrust forward. For a moment, the only part of him to move was the dark and velvety skin of his muzzle, first twitching back to reveal the clenched needles of his teeth, then relaxing to hide them, then twitching back again. The bugs came on. Whatever they were, the turtle maturin upraised in the pear's hand meant nothing to them. A fat guy wearing a tuxedo with plaid lapels spoke weakly, almost questioningly, to the bird thing.
They weren't to come any further than here, my man, nor to leave. We were told—
Oi lunged forward, a growl coming through his clamped teeth. It was a decidedly un-Oi-like sound, reminding Callahan of a comic strip balloon.
Arr!
No, Jake shouted, alarmed. No, Oi! At the sound of the boy's shout, the yells and laughter from behind the tapestry abruptly ceased, as if the falcon back there had suddenly become aware that something had changed in the front room. Oi took no notice of Jake's cry. He crunched three of the bugs in rapid succession, the crackle of their breaking carapaces gruesomely clear in the new stillness. He made no attempt to eat them, but simply tossed the corpses, each the size of a mouse, into the air with a snap of the neck and a grinning release of the jaws. And the others retreated back under the tables.
He was made for this, Callahan thought. Perhaps once in the long ago, all bumblers were. Made for it the way some breeds of terrier are made to—
A hoarse shout from behind the tapestry interrupted these thoughts.
Humes! One voice cried, and then a second, Cahumes!
Callahan had an absurd impulse to yell Gesundheit. Before he could yell that or anything else, Roland's voice suddenly filled his head. 6.
Jake, go!
The boy turned toward Per Callahan, bewildered. He was walking with his arms crossed, ready to fling the risers at the first low man or woman who moved. Oi had returned to his heel, although he was swinging his head ceaselessly from side to side, and his eyes were bright with the prospect of more prey.
"We go together," Jake said. "They're buffaloed, Pear. And we're close. They took her through here, this room, and then through the kitchen."
Callahan paid no attention. Still holding the turtle high, as one might hold a lantern in a deep cave, he had turned toward the tapestry. The silence from behind it was far more terrible than the shouts and feverish, gargling laughter. It was silence like a pointed weapon. And the boy had stopped.
"Go while you can," Callahan said, striving for calmness. "Catch up to her if you can. This is the command of your din. This is also the will of the white. But you can't go, Jake."
The low men and women in the Dixie Pig, whether enthralled to the Sholpada or not, murmured uneasily at the sound of that shout, and well they might have, for it was not Callahan's voice coming from Callahan's mouth.
"You have this one chance and must take it. Find her. As din, I command you."
Jake's eyes flew wide at the sound of Roland's voice issuing from Callahan's throat. His mouth dropped open. He looked around, dazed. In the second before the tapestry to their left was torn aside, Callahan saw its black joke, what the careless eye would first surely overlook. The roast that was the banquet's main entree had a human form. The knights and their ladies were eating human flesh and drinking human blood. What the tapestry showed was a cannibal's communion. Then the ancient ones, who had been at their own sup, tore aside the obscene tapestry and burst out, shrieking through the great fangs that propped their deformed mouths forever open. Their eyes were as black as blindness, the skin of their cheeks and brows, even the backs of their hands, tumorous with wild teeth. Like the vampires in the dining room, they were surrounded with auras, but these were of a poisoned violet, so dark it was almost black. Some sort of ichor dribbled from the corners of their eyes and mouths. They were gibbering, and several were laughing, seeming not to create the sounds, but rather to snatch them out of the air like something that could be rent alive. And Callahan knew them. Of course he did. Had he not been sent hence by one of their number? Here were the true vampires, the type ones, kept like a secret and now loosed on the intruders. The turtle he held up did not slow them in the slightest. Callahan saw Jake staring, pale, eyes shiny with horror and bulging from their sockets, all purpose forgotten at the sight of these freaks. Without knowing what was going to come out of his mouth until he heard it, Callahan shouted, "They'll kill Oi first! They'll kill him in front of you and drink his blood!" Oi barked at the sound of his name. Jake's eyes seemed to clear at the sound, but Callahan had no time to follow the boy's fortunes further.
"Turtle won't stop them, but at least it's holding the others back. Bullets won't stop them, but—"
With a sense of déjà vu, and why not, he had lived all this before in the home of a boy named Mark Petrie. Callahan dipped into the open front of his shirt and brought out the cross he wore there. It clicked against the butt of the Ruger and then hung below it. The cross was lit with a brilliant bluish-white glare. The two ancient things in the lead had been about to grab him and draw him into their midst. Now they drew back instead, shrieking with pain. Callahan saw the surface of their skin sizzle and begin to liquefy. The sight of it filled him with savage happiness.
"Get back from me," he shouted. "The power of God commands you. The power of Christ commands you. The Ka of Midworld commands you. The power of the white commands you."
One of them darted forward nevertheless, a deformed skeleton in an ancient moss-encrusted dinner suit. Around its neck it wore some sort of ancient award, the cross of Malta, perhaps? It swiped one of its long-nailed hands at the crucifix Callahan was holding out. He jerked it down at the last second, and the vampire's claw passed an inch above it. Callahan lunged forward without thought and drove the tip of the cross into the yellow parchment of the thing's forehead. The gold crucifix went in like a red-hot skewer into butter. The thing in the rusty dinner suit let out a liquid cry of pained dismay and stumbled backward. Callahan pulled his cross back. For one moment, before the elderly monster clapped its claws to its brow, Callahan saw the hole his cross had made. Then a thick, curdy, yellow stuff began to spill through the ancient one's fingers. Its knees unhinged, and it tumbled to the floor between two tables.
Its mates shrank away from it, screaming with outrage. The thing's face was already collapsing inward beneath its twisted hands. Its aura whiffed out like a candle, and then there was nothing but a puddle of yellow